So this is the oral law class, and it's the final oral law class. Since I don't really know what you've done and what you haven't done, I'm going to talk about something completely different, which is basically I want to talk about the history of Kabbalah and how that applies to the oral law, how that applies to halacha, how that applies to what you're supposed to believe or not believe. This was kind of triggered by an email I got last week from somebody who had a whole list of questions about the Kabbalah and the Zohar, the questions are, why was the Kabbalah accepted if it contradicts earlier concepts? Why do we have to follow the majority opinion? It was, if most people accept Kabbalah/Zohar, why do we have to accept the majority opinion if it's not halacha? Right, is there such a thing as following the majority of something that's not halachic? That's not really a question. If we believe in the Zohar, does that mean we can't believe in the Rambam, who didn't know about the Zohar? And does the idea there's no such thing as coincidence come from the Zohar? So those are all really interesting questions, and I hope to try and answer all of them in this class. So I'm going to start with an introduction to the history of Kabbalah, which is taken basically from this book, which is a good introduction if you want to learn Kabbalah. It's called Shomer HaEmunim, Shomer Emunim HaKadmon. Now there is a Hasidic sefer called Shomer Emunim, which is not this. Shomer Emunim HaKadmon, written by Rav Yosef Irgas. I don't remember exactly which year, but there's an introduction to this book written by the chief rabbi of Givat Shaul of 80 years ago, where he takes bits from the book and puts together. This book is basically both a defense of Kabbalah and an introduction to Kabbalistic concepts. So the introduction is a history of the Kabbalah and where it comes from and how we have it. I actually translated this introduction, and you can look at it on the Torah Lab website, torahlab.org, search for Kabbalah, or if you go to Twitter, which I just started Twittering, which is pretty stupid, if you go to Twitter and look me up, I just put a link to it today, so you can find the link to the English translation of this, in case you don't believe what I'm saying, which won't help, because I translate it, so you might not believe me there either. I think it's important to make a distinction, three distinctions. First of all, there's the Kabbalah, or Sisrei Torah, Sod, all sorts of different words for the secret parts of Torah. One idea. There's a book called the Zohar, which is often used as synonymous with Kabbalah, but which is in fact, the Zohar is a book connected to the Kabbalah, but they're not identical. And then there's a modern concept called the mystics say, or it's a Kabbalistic idea, or any kind of random thing, which either means I can't be bothered explaining it to you right now, or it's too difficult to explain to you right now, or I don't know. And very often I've heard people speak and say, the mystics say such and such, and I happen to know that it's explicit in the Gemara somewhere. It's not, I mean, the Gemara is also mystical, I suppose, but and the simple answer, if we have to accept these or not, in a word, I think we do have to accept there is such a thing as the hidden part of the Torah. I think my opinion is denying that there is a hidden part of the Torah is denying the part of the oral Torah, which probably makes a person into a heretic. I think that it seems that most people, including some of the most intelligent people of the last few hundred years, have accepted the validity of the Zohar, despite evidence, even though it may not be. So I think that it is sensible to accept that the Zohar is an authentic book, but I don't think one is obligated to accept it's an authentic book. But the truth, it doesn't really make that much difference, because Kabbalah doesn't come from the Zohar, but Zohar is a text from which Kabbalah is derived. So you could not believe in the Zohar and still believe in Kabbalah, and vice versa. And in terms of things that people say are Kabbalistic/mystical ideas, I don't think you have to believe any of them unless they can back them up with some kind of statement of some sort of reliable authority. Yeah.
I think I missed it. The Zohar was written from the Gemara, or it was given to Moshe Sinai, or...
I'm going to talk about that.
Oh, okay.
as we're going to talk about. Okay, so that's the simple answer to whether you have to accept these or not, in my opinion. You're welcome to disagree. Moshe received on Har Sinai, as we know, the Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh. Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, was written and was passed down as a written Torah, and we have that today as the Chumash. The men of the Great Assembly added to it, codified it as the whole Tanakh. That's all Torah Shebichtav. One of the principles of faith, and Pashtus is the principle of faith of Rambam, is that along with the written Torah, there's also an oral Torah, which includes many, if not all, of the laws, explanations of the written Torah, and according to the Gemara in Megillah Yud Zayin, even including later rabbinic decrees, were all given to Moshe at Mount Sinai. Although presumably, according to the Tosfos Yontif, were not passed down. Moshe didn't come down from Mount Sinai and tell people there's going to be a festival called Chanukah in another 1500 years. Because the Chashmonai, it wouldn't make any sense, or there's going to be a festival called Megillah and you're going to have to read this book that about people that don't exist yet. It's a bit odd to say that. But the Gemara definitely says that Moshe received on Sinai, he knew all the halachas, including Mikra Megillah. So that is, I think, normative Judaism would say that Moshe received the written and the oral Torah on Mount Sinai. And I don't want to get into technical ideas of what is the written Torah and what is the oral Torah and which bits he received, which bits he didn't receive, and what you have to believe. Part of the oral Torah that Moshe received is the hidden part of the Torah. We say there's four levels of understanding of Torah, of parades, pshat, remez, drash, and sod. Pshat is a simple meaning. Pshat is a simple meaning, as it says. Remez is allusions within the words, things like gematria, things like first letters or words that are spelt one way and read a different way. We learn halachas from both the pshat and the remez, meaning, for example, the halacha that a nazir, if he doesn't specify how long he wants to be a nazir for, it should be for 30 days, is learned from the gematria of the word yihyeh, which is 30. The Gemara learns that. That's remez, and we learn halacha from that. Drash is anything you want to say in the words. Drash can bear almost any interpretation and is not halachic. And sod is the hidden parts of the Torah, which again are not halachic, which are probably more fundamental, which are which come to teach us of the way that God interacts with the world, which come to teach us how the world works, how God works, and how God and the world works.
So, Drash and Sod aren't halachic, but remez and pshat are?
I think so. Drash is what you say around the Shabbos table. Right? There's, this word and that word and this story and that fits with that and a nice Devar Torah. Usually it's a drash type thing. You're not coming to derive a halacha from that. You're trying to say something that makes the words come alive or makes the concept or whatever it was going
on. Derive halacha based on the gematria. It's binding halacha.
If there is a binding halacha that's derived from gematria, then it's binding.
Was there an example?
The nazir is for 30 days.
Okay.
I can't think of very many others. There are a few, but there's not many. The truth is that pshat doesn't... The halacha doesn't come from pshat either. Really, otherwise we'd be poking people's eyes out for eye for an eye and things like that. The halacha comes from the oral law's interpretation of the written law, which is not necessarily the... I mean, I think the Gemara would claim that eye for an eye, the pshat there is money. Right? But it's not what you or I would read as the pshat reading. So I think that the hidden Torah, which we can call Kabbalah, just because... The funny thing about Kabbalah is it doesn't actually seem to be a Kabbalah, necessarily. Right? Kabbalah means a received tradition. And it's the least well-documented received part of the Torah. Right? The great halachic authorities, part of the reason you rely on them is because you know who the teachers were. You know where they received their tradition from. You know what their... Masorah is, you know what their validity is. The greatest Kabbalistic teachers learned their Torah from Eliyahu HaNavi, and therefore, or learned from teachers who didn't know as much as they did, or learned. So we don't. The Kabbalah is a misnomer. if it means received tradition, it seems that it's not actually necessarily received in the way. And having a Masorah in Kabbalah doesn't seem to be as important as having a Masorah in Halacha. But Kabbalah tells us how to do the mitzvah of Yichud Hashem. Kabbalah tells us about God and about the world and about our role in the world. And that's the mitzvah you're doing when you're learning Kabbalah. It probably is Talmud Torah, but it's also the mitzvah of Yichud Hashem, of understanding the unity of God. So again, so anyone who denies that there is such a thing as the hidden parts of the Torah is probably a heretic. Certainly is outside mainstream normative Judaism, in my opinion. Anyone who accepts everything that's ever said in the name of Kabbalah is a fool. Because anyone who accepts everything that anybody says, this is Kabbalah says this, Zohar says that, do this because it's mystics say. If you just accept everything people tell you because they say the word Kabbalah, then you're a fool, in my opinion. If you say there's no such thing at all, then you're a heretic. So you can choose. The oral law, as you know, was passed down as an oral tradition for more than 1,000 years, probably 1,500 years, from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu until at least the time of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, although it probably wasn't even written until after that. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi compiled the oral law into the Mishnah, Ravina Rav Ashi compiled the oral law into the Gemara. It's not clear when it was actually written down as a standardized text, but it became a codified document. Mishnah in the year 200 of the Common Era, the Gemara in about the year 500, and was written down somewhere around that time, which is a long time after Moshe Rabbeinu. People made notes for themselves of oral law. They were called Megillat Starim, hidden scrolls. People used to write notes they kept for themselves to help them remember everything that they were doing, and they would keep them hidden in secret and then put them in Geniza before they died, and they would disappear occasionally. The Gemara talks about finding something that someone had written and what it said, but it was an oral tradition. There were also Kabbalistic books in inverted commas, right, that were handed down as part of the oral tradition, which date back to, as far as we know, date back to at least Har Sinai, Matan Torah, possibly even earlier. They include the three books of Sefer Yetzirah, which is attributed either to Adam Arishon or to Avraham Avinu, Sefer Abahir, and Pirkei Hechalos, which are three very early Kabbalistic books. They are quoted by many of the earliest written documents that we have, allude to them or cite them, reference them. The Ramban, for example, quotes from all three of those, I believe.
What was the last one?
Pirkei Hechalos.
Pirkei what?
Hechalot.
What is it?
Chapters of Sanctuaries.
Oh.
Hechalot. Hechalos. Yeah, I don't think anyone has ever questioned the authenticity of those documents in terms of being very ancient Jewish documents. Whether they go back to Avraham Avinu or not is a moot point, but they go back as far as we have any records of anything going back. The tricky bit is when you get to the Zohar, which is not quoted ever by the Ramban, for example. Ramban knew a lot of Kabbalah. He never quotes the Zohar, even though he says, he does, let me rephrase that, he never says the Zohar says X. He does say phrases that appear in the Zohar, but he doesn't say the Zohar says. So whether that means he had bits of the Zohar but not the whole book, or he had the Zohar but didn't want to mention the name, or what it means, I don't know. But he does quote Sefer Yetzirah and Sefer Bahir. So the Zohar is attributed to Shimon bar Yochai, the Tana, Rabbi Shimon in the Mishnah, the student of Rabbi Akiva, but didn't appear as a book until much, much later. Much, much later. And the controversy about the validity of Kabbalah is really not about that at all, but about the validity of the Zohar, I think. So again, just to say, there are books of Kabbalah that are authentic, that exist, that we know, we have records of. The Zohar is more problematic. The reason it's problematic is because it really only was only published in the 13th century. which is comparatively late. So, Shamir Munim claims that the secrets of the Kabbalah were passed down, as opposed to the written law was given to everybody, the oral law was given to large numbers of people, the revealed oral law, the secret Torah was given only to unique individuals. The Mishnah in Chagiga talks about the fact you can't teach Maisa Merkava, Maisa Bereishis to more than two people at once. Talks about the type of student you can teach it to. It was only ever very few people who knew the traditions of the secrets of the Torah. In the time of the Gaonim, it seems that they had secret parts of the Torah, but the Rambam, for example, does not seem to have had any access to Sisrei Torah. There's allegedly a document, which I hope is a forgery. The Abar Benel, Shomer Munim quotes the Abar Benel, who says he saw a letter written by Rambam saying that at the end of his life a man came from a faraway country and taught him the secrets of Kabbalah, and when he realized all of that, if he would have had time, he would have retracted everything he said until then and started all over again, but he couldn't, because it was the end of his life. I find that a very, very disturbing statement. I mean, it's odd that it's unlikely to be true for all sorts of historical reasons, but I find it very disturbing that the Rambam would want to retract whatever he wrote. But it's certainly true that the Rambam never ever mentions anything mystical or Kabbalistic at all.
What would be the purpose of only having Kabbalah be among a few people?
Because it's esoteric wisdom of that most people don't need for their daily lives.
But isn't there a danger of it dying out?
I think it would be a greater danger. The thinking was it would be a greater danger for it to become public than for it to be to die. I mean, it didn't die out. They were careful to try and keep it not dying out. And it didn't die out. I mean, there's a chain of transmission going all the way back. But there were people who were left out. There were countries that were left out. There were times when it was very, very much underground.
What countries never were touched by
it? Most of the Kabbalists in the Middle Ages were in Spain and Provence rather than in Europe or in Africa, I think. But that changed in the time of the Arizal, where he came from Egypt with all these Kabbalistic secrets. So different times in different places. But I don't think... For example, Russian Tosas talk about Kabbalistic ideas. They talk about hidden parts of the Torah. But I don't know if they were tapped into a Masorah of Kabbalah, of hidden wisdom. The Ravid, who is the Ravid who argues on the Rambam, had this tradition of Kabbalah, and he taught his son, who's called Yitzchak the Blind, and he taught his two students, Rabbi Ezra and Rabbi Israel, and from there went to the Ramban, who was the first person to really write openly Kabbalistic ideas. If you look in the Ramban Nachmanides, if you look in his commentary on Torah, there's many places where he says Hamevin Yavin, or that's the simple meaning, here's the deeper meaning, the sod meaning. If you look in the Art Scroll translation of Ramban, they did not translate any of those bits that are Kabbalistic. There was a discussion between the publishers and the translators about whether or not to put in these Kabbalistic passages. One side saying just translate the words and don't explain what it means. The other side saying that you can't just translate the words without saying what it means because it's meaningless. Or worse, it'll be misunderstood to mean something that it's not. And the bottom line is they just say this bit is Kabbalistic and we've left it out. So you can
see. They write it in?
They write the words. This next piece has been left out because it's Kabbalistic. I don't remember exactly nusach they use, but if you look in the article of Ramban, they left out all the bits where the Ramban says he's speaking Kabbalistically.
Mm-hmm. The Ramban, this is the Ramban's own work as opposed, like, he came after the Zohar was written?
He came, he lived before the Zohar was published.
When was the Zohar published?
13th century, and Ramban was 12th century. Or early, he was beginning of the 13th century, and the Zohar was the end of the century.
Ramban was after Ramban, right?
Only just, a little bit after. So Rambam died in 1205, I think. Sorry about that. So Rambam was the first half of the 13th century. And the Zohar, Moshe de Leon, who I'm going to talk about in a minute, was the second half of the 13th century. Rabbeinu Bachaye, who was a Talmud of the Rambam, does quote the Zohar. So it was about that time that the Zohar became publicized. But I think it could be the Rambam had it. He does quote bits of the Zohar word for word. But he never says the name Zohar. So the Zohar, this book called the Zohar, was written by Shimon Bar Yochai in a cave in Meron. In the time of the Gaonim, it was broken up according to Parshas, according to the Chumash. It was the appropriate bits were put on the appropriate Pesukim in the Torah. So that now the Zohar goes according to Parshas in the Torah. And it was rediscovered by Rabbi Moshe de Leon, who died in 1305. He was the first person to publicize the book called the Zohar. He had it. This is when was Gutenberg? Much later. Moshe de Leon. Yeah. He published it, publicized it, and there was great controversy at the time. Controversy in two ways. One is that some people want to know where he got it from and whether it was genuine, authentic, or whether he made it up. And other people said it is genuine and therefore we can't publicize it because the stuff's supposed to be kept secret and hidden and shouldn't be made public. There's a whole story about where he got it from, how it came to him. There was a king who was waging war in India and they discovered in one of the spoils of war was this chest, and opened the chest, and inside the chest was a book and written in a funny language. They went to all the people in the world and they couldn't find what language it was, and they came to the Jews and said, oh, this is our book, this is the Zohar, we've been looking for this for a long time. And it came to Moshe de Leon somehow, and he published and publicized it. It was whether the story is true or not, I don't know. There's no clear. We can't really trace it back. Now the truth is, you can't trace anything from the 13th century anyway. Where books came from and how they appear, and whatever. Everything is, there's a lot of guesswork involved in everything. But it seems that there's no mention or reference to it in written text before Moshe de Leon, and after that there are many written texts and it becomes a standardized book. What is the Zohar? The Zohar is a collection of Midrashim. It's written in Aramaic. Some of the people, there have been, since the publication of the Zohar, and even as recently as Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who lived in the 18th century, there have been people who said that it's a forgery, that it's not a genuine document. There's many reasons why they say this. It's written in an Aramaic, a version of Aramaic, that doesn't seem to be contemporary with Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, who in the Mishnah speaks in Hebrew. And there's all sorts of phrases. People do linguistic analysis on this document and say that it can't be dated as early as it is. It must be a later document or a forgery or a cobble. Fine, okay. And again, Rabbi Yaakov Emden was not only one of the greatest rabbis, probably the most brilliant rabbi, before the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon was a very young man when Rabbi Yaakov Emden had his big controls, Jonas Leibschitz. Rabbi Yaakov was completely and utterly brilliant and a big Kabbalist. And he wrote a whole book attacking the Zohar, saying it's a forgery and saying it certainly cannot be from as early as Shimon Bar Yochai. The book is called, I've forgotten, sitting on my shelf, what's it called? Okay, I can't remember. And he attacks it for all sorts of reasons based on names of people in there and language and ideas in there and all sorts of things, but in no way would you say that he was against Kabbalah. He certainly knew Kabbalah, wrote about Kabbalah, mentions Kabbalah, Paskan Halacha based on Kabbalah. So the Zohar and the Kabbalah are not necessarily synonymous. And the truth is that the Zohar, just like the Gemara, can sounds really bad. The Gemara can almost, certainly the Agadic bits of the Gemara, can be made to say whatever you want them to say within certain limits. There's no single meaning. In Halacha, there's more clear meaning, and it's been debated. In Agada, in the Gemara, there's many different opinions about what the Agada means. In the Zohar, the same thing. There's no one clear meaning of what the Zohar means in most passages. They can be understood in different ways. Most of them were not understood at all, or not in very clear ways. Right. But so the Zohar itself, certainly the Zohar, You can even buy it in English, and you're not going to turn to a frog, and unfortunately you can't really say you're learning Kabbalah, because it's just Midrashim, and not Kabbalah. However, Kabbalah does use ideas and concepts from the Zohar as proof text for ideas, for arguments that it's making. Rav Moshe Cordovero, the Ramak, who wrote a book called Toma Devora, that's his most famous book, he also wrote a whole encyclopedia called the Parades, where he tries to explain the Zohar and answer up all the contradictions and explains what everything means. And he was part of the Tzfat Kabbalistic crowd of very holy rabbis, contemporary of Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch. I think brother-in-law of the Alkabetz who wrote Lecha Dodi. Alkabetz. I think he's the brother-in-law. He might certainly contemporary. I'm not sure. And Rav Moshe Cordovero also had the privilege of teaching Kabbalah to the Arizal for a very short while. The Arizal, I think, was in Tzfat for 2 years altogether. So for a very short while, he learnt Kabbalah from Rav Moshe Cordovero. However, the Arizal revolutionized Kabbalah. He introduced concepts that hadn't been known before, or hadn't existed before, or hadn't been understood before, and his understanding of the Zohar is so radically different. I've never studied either his book or Moshe Cordovero's book, but you see Moshe Cordovero writes a book like this, and the Arizal writes a book like this, and answers the same questions. He's got a whole new, in maths, when Einstein comes up with theory, it just changes the way that maths is done. It's based on Newtonian physics, but everything becomes different. When you switch from Euclidean geometry into post-Einstein geometry, everything changes. The same numbers now mean different things. The same thing in Kabbalah. The Arizal was a sea change in the way that Kabbalah was understood and learned. There's new terminology, there's new concepts, there's new ideas, new ways that things interact, and new meanings in the Zohar. That, again, he probably had from Masora. Either he had it from Masora or he learned from Eliyahu HaNavi, depending on which version of the story you like. But it wasn't publicized before the Arizal. My definition of Kabbalah, whether it's right or wrong, is, in other words, anything, let me say it differently, anything before the Arizal is a very different kind of Kabbalah than anything after the Arizal. Anything that doesn't come from the writings of the Arizal is not what people today learn call Kabbalah. So the Ramban's Kabbalah, it's great and exciting and interesting, but it's not a system that really we can understand nowadays. There are people who write mystical things who seem to have who never mention Kabbalah. For example, the Maharal, who was a contemporary basically of Reb Chaim, of the Arizal, never came to learn from him, never really mentions anything Kabbalistic, but maybe I'm making a semantic difference between mysticism and Kabbalah, but the ideas he's saying that could almost be Greek philosophical ideas just turned into Jewish concepts rather than something like the Arizal, which is just a completely different way of looking at things. Certainly not the Arizal's Kabbalah. The Maharal, as far as I know, does not mention any of the Kabbalistic books. And he says all his ideas as mystical ideas, and they're all very profound and meaningful and deep. But I personally wouldn't say that if you're learning Maharal, you're learning Kabbalah. Which is good, since many, many people learn Maharal, and probably many people are not appropriate for learning Kabbalah. So after the Arizal, everything changed. The Arizal didn't write very much himself, but his works were written down by his former student called Reb Chaim Vital. Reb Chaim Vital wrote all sorts of notes and books and instructed that they should be buried with him when he died. He didn't want them out in the marketplace. That didn't stop him writing an introduction in case it was published. Anyway, they did, allegedly, he died and was buried with these books, and then they decided that they should dig them up and publish them anyway in direct opposition to his expressed wishes. Because this is stuff that needs to be known. So when people are learning Kabbalah nowadays, the starting point of Kabbalah is a book called the Etz Chaim, which is a collection of sayings of the Arizal put together by Reb Chaim Vital. There may be, or probably is, another tradition of Arizal Kabbalah, which was ignored or became secondary or disappeared, which is from the Maharis Srug, I think it was Israel Srug, who learnt by the Arizal for a very short time and went then to Europe, and seems to have a different system of Kabbalah than Reb Chaim Vital, which may have been passed on to the Rama Mipano, Rav, I forgot his name, Menachem Azariah, Fano, and the different systems within the different worlds, different ideas within the Kabbalah of the Arizal. Either it's a different understanding, or it's a different tradition, or it's said at different times. Normally, people are learning Reb Chaim Vital when learning Kabbalah. Along came, this is the 16th century. In the 17th century, you've got Shabtai Tzvi, who used Kabbalah to lead people well away from Judaism, ending up himself converting to Islam and leading many of his followers to either become Muslim or to become very depressed. And this was a major disaster. One of the reasons that Shabtai Tzvi was so successful, apart from his charismatic personality and apart from the fact that people were looking for a messiah after Chmelnytsky, one of the things was that anything he said was Kabbalistic, people believed him because nobody knew what really was authentic Kabbalah and what was not authentic Kabbalah. So if he said the Kabbalah says, the Zohar says, you know, the opposite of halacha, and this is what it means, Kabbalah says you're supposed to become Muslim, so people didn't have the capability of arguing with him or saying yes or no. So there were, and after Shabtai Tzvi died, there was still a strong Sabbatean movement. After him there was Frank, after him there was Chayyim. There were different people in the false messiah movement using Kabbalah to put out a different spin on Judaism. There were two responses to this, basically. One response was to ban learning Kabbalah because it's dangerous. The other response was to teach everybody Kabbalah. The ban on Kabbalah is from 1756, I think, which was the Ramchal was run out of town for teaching Kabbalah publicly, for doing weird things with Kabbalah. Ramchal knew everything from the Arizal by the age of 13. He was a complete genius and brilliant and knew Kabbalah backwards and forwards, and they threw him out of town, and he ended up in Holland. Why? Because a young charismatic personality teaching Kabbalah is very dangerous, because that's what Shabtai Tzvi was, and so they made a ban on learning Kabbalah.
What was the weird stuff that he was doing?
The Ramchal. There were all sorts of weird things.
Like we're like marrying Torah weird, Shabbat weird, or like
Things that weren't done. I mean, things. There was some of them which I guess nowadays you'd think were from. You know, he had people learning Torah 24 hours a day. He had all sorts of rules in his base midrash of what you could or couldn't do. He had all sorts of secret gatherings and secret books and things that people didn't have access to. He also wrote all sorts of. He wrote plays, Italian plays. He wrote love poetry. He did all sorts of things that were not accepted at the time. They made a ban. I think the council in Worms. Your question?
Yeah. Are his plays and poetry still?
They're not in the complete series of Ramchal books, but you can get them in the Hebrew University. I think so. Yeah. Go to the Hebrew University Library. It's just over there. So they put a ban on learning Kabbalah until the age of 40. Of course, the Ramchal died at the age of 39. The Arizal died at the age of 39. Many of the main Kabbalists died either late 30s or early 40s.
It's a weird coincidence.
Wait, what? I didn't hear you say.
Like a weird coincidence, they all died relatively young.
We don't believe in coincidence.
That's why I made the foot fingers.
I don't know. I think they say that the Ramchal was a Gilgul of Rabbi Akiva.
Oh.
Ramchal? Rabbi Akiva started learning Torah when he was 40, and the Ramchal died when he was 39, and it was a tikkun for, I think, but I may have made that up, so I don't know.
Are they buried, like, next to each other?
I think so.
Yeah, right. It was, like, across the thing.
So I don't know if they're buried next to each other because they're Gilgulim, or if people think they're Gilgulim because they're buried next to each other. So they banned learning Kabbalah. There's only three exceptions, which are: it's permitted to learn the Zohar, it's permitted to learn Shomer Emunim, this book here, and it's permitted to learn the Sefer Paras of Moshe Kodavira. If you're 30, you can learn those books.
What's the third one called?
Sefer HaParades.
Sefer HaParades.
And the second one?
Shomer Emunim.
Both of these you could get?
Today?
Sefer HaParades.
This is Shomer Emunim. It's only a thin book. Only cost... No, I don't know. There's no price in it. You can get this in any good bookstore. Well, not many, but if you know where to look. It's a Hebrew book. I mean, I think it's...
Language aside, I don't think...
I don't know.
Is it Kabbalah-ish enough?
It is Kabbalah. It is Kabbalah.
And we're not men over 40. Or is there not...
Over 30. If you're a man over 30, you can do it.
Oh, so
this for this book. This will apply, I don't know. I would say that you shouldn't learn it, but if you want to know what's actual authentic Jewish mysticism and what someone's like OCD or something, then you have to know, you have to have a basic familiarity. You either have to have someone you trust who knows this stuff, or you have to do your research and find it yourself. So this is a very basic introduction to Kabbalah.
You can learn it, you can, like, let's say, I don't know if you do or don't study Kabbalah, but I'm saying, let's say hypothetically.
See, this is I've got to say I don't, but I've got to say I don't even if I do, so you won't believe me that I don't, but I don't.
Okay. So let's say,
but I know somebody
hypothetically,
does. Yes.
You did.
Yes.
Wait, you know?
I'm 40 now, as of last week, so I can learn it now.
Yay.
Thank you. Yes. The only problem is I've got to know all of Shas and Poskim first, which I haven't done yet. That's the slight technical problem.
Okay. So let's say you did, though.
Yes.
Could you give that over to us in a, like, a watered-down version so we wouldn't be doing anything usher? Or...
I could certainly tell you enough to make sure you're not doing something that's Avodah Zarah and thinking it's Kabbalah.
But okay, not saying for Sakana reasons. I'm saying.
Yeah, everybody learns Kabbalah nowadays, especially women who can't learn Gemara. They all learn Kabbalah. Everyone's learning Kabbalah. All watered down Kabbalah. All Hasidus is watered down. This was saying. On one hand, they ban learning Kabbalah. As response to Shabbat Tzvi. On the other hand, as I talked about a different class, the Baal Shem Tov publicized learning Kabbalah as a response to Shabbat Tzvi. He wanted everyone to learn Kabbalah, made Kabbalah accessible to the layman. The Tanya, if you've ever gone to any Lubavitch organization, they'll teach you Tanya. And Tanya is definitely a Kabbalistic book. So the people who banned learning Kabbalah say you can't learn Kabbalah until you're 40. Very often it's taught like, you know, it's, as if it's davening, so you don't learn any Kabbalah from it anyway. But if you had actually learn the Tanya properly with your thumbs and everything, then it's a Kabbalistic book.
So how come that one is going at 30? Well, I can't, but you can.
What? How come what? Is that?
So that book is 30, not 40, right?
Yes, I'm saying there's two different... On the one hand, it's all Asa, on the other hand, it's all Mutter. And those are two different responses to Shabbatai Tzvi.
And how do we today know...
I think everyone's learning Kabbalah today, except that it's so watered down that no one knows whether it's real Kabbalah or fake Kabbalah.
Like Madonna Kabbalah or actual
Kabbalah? You know, I'm not talking about Madonna, I'm talking about Jewish fake Kabbalah.
Oh, Jewish fake Kabbalah.
People say all sorts of things which I think are absolutely paganistic and Avodah Zarah.
Red string.
In the name of Kabbalah. Yeah, red string is certainly not Kabbalistic. That's for sure just plain old Avodah Zarah.
Oh, really? Is Avodah Zarah? Here's
my answer.
She
disappeared. Okay.
She's little.
I'll find her.
Okay.
Yes.
Rabbi Nachman, he taught, like, in his teachings, there was a lot of.
Kabbalah, right, the Balsh, exactly. All the Hasidic rabbis basically said watered down Kabbalah for the layman. Right. So the Baal Shem Tov and the Magid of Mezrich and the Baal HaTanya and Rav Nachman and the, you know, all of them. And nowadays everyone's learning the, no, what's the red book? There's a class on it in the school.
The red string bad red.
The which one? No, not Kazari. Nazir Shalom. Nazir Shalom is Kabbalah for the layman, watered down Kabbalah, Kabbalistic idea. Well, that's what.
It's a good class.
Yeah, no, 100%. So I'm saying everyone's learning Kabbalah nowadays. This whole thing of banning Kabbalah, not learning Kabbalah.
Thank you.
Okay, so it's not talking about.
From the Zohar Kabbalah, that's like.
He quotes Zohar over there. Nobody learns Kabbalah from. You don't learn Kabbalah from Zohar. That's right. You don't learn Kabbalah from Zohar. You learn Kabbalah from the Eitz Chaim. If you're a Chassid, you learn Kabbalah of the Eitz Chaim through Rav Tzadik and Baal HaTanya and Chiddushei Arim and Sfas Emes and whatever. If you're a Litvak, you learn the Kabbalah of the Zohar of the Etz Chaim through the Gra and through the Leshem, or through the Ramchal and through Rav Yitzchak Isaac Chaver. If you're a Sfardi, you learn Kabbalah through the Rosh Hashanah's commentary on the Etz Chaim. So there's correct, and they actually disagree with each other on very fundamental issues. So there's no such thing as the Kabbalah says, but there's different ways of understanding the world based on different things, and basically everyone is learning Kabbalistic ideas. It's just part of what's accepted, but you can't tell the difference between what's an authentic Kabbalistic idea and what's not. So I think it's worth having somebody who knows Kabbalah, who you trust, who can you can say, is this getting rid of Ayin Haras. I don't know if anyone been to do that or heard of doing that, right?
There's
a guy in Kabbalah, he gets rid of your Ayin Haras. He takes boiled lead, I think, and drops it into water, and it forms little eye shapes, and he, like, whatever, I haven't seen it, but yeah, my chavrusa went into this once. You pull out like half a dozen eyes from the water, and you say, I just got all these Ayin Haras from you, and now you go out your life, and everyone lives happily ever after, and it's amazing, and it works, and it's brilliant.
I went.
Yeah, and it worked. And it worked?
Yeah, I think
right.
It worked,
okay.
Yes.
So is that authentic Judaism or is that pagan Avodah Zarah? Mm-hmm. Right? You have to be able to go and know.
I'm pretty authentic to me. Because
he's got a big beard with black hat, he's in Gola, right? And there are many, I mean, it probably is. I'm not.
His mother was doing it like for 50 years.
Correct.
And she died from her.
Correct.
So I'm
picking that example because I think it is authentic. But you wouldn't be able to tell.
I wouldn't know the difference.
You wouldn't know the difference between this, whether this is Avodah Zarah or this is authentic Kabbalah. That's what I'm saying.
So the red string is still Avodah Zarah. How come, like, I mean, I heard Rabbi Manning talk about it when we talked about pathways. Like, having people on pathways return and buy red string stuff. And he was like, he said it's.
Yeah, but he and I both learned from the same teacher. So you can't trust both of us.
That's not surprising at all. Who's your teacher?
Doesn't matter. Rav Cook writes in Orot HaTorah that nowadays people should be learning more Kabbalah. That learning Kabbalah is important. Where did he learn it from? So there's a big machlokas. Some say he learned from the Leshem, who was the Leshem was Rav Elyashiv's grandfather. He was also called Rav Elyashiv, and he knew Rav Cook. They learned in the same place for a couple of years. Rav Cook was, I believe, there was a Masada Kedushin at Rav Elyashiv's wedding because he'd known his grandfather, which probably the Rav Elyashiv people today would not want the Rav Cook people to know about such a fact. But so some people say he learnt his Kabbalah from the Leshem, but from what I've seen and what I've heard, it seems much more likely that he's got a Hasidic version of Kabbalah from people like Rav Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin. There's a lot of ideas, and I don't really understand much of Rav Cook ever, and I don't understand much of Rav Tzadok, so I guess they're probably both the same thing. But it seems to me that Rav Cook is more coming from a Hasidic idea than from the Leshem, who's the worst insult. There's a correspondence between the Leshem and Rav Naftali Hertz, who was the chief rabbi of Yafo. And they're discussing ideas in Kabbalah back and forth. And I mean, I did try looking at this, and I couldn't even understand what the words meant, let alone what they were talking about. But when the Leshem really wants to insult somebody really badly, he calls them a chassid. So the worst insult you could say. So I think that Rav Cook's Kabbalah came from Hasidus, but I don't know enough about Rav Cook, or I haven't understood enough of him to be able to really answer that definitively. But it seems that's my opinion. But Rav Cook does say that you should learn Kabbalah nowadays. Rav Chaim Vital, in his introduction to the Etz Chaim, say the reason Mashiach hasn't come is because people aren't learning Kabbalah. There's a lot of people nowadays who say that you should learn Kabbalah, even if, notwithstanding the ban and even if everything else, that learning Kabbalah will make Mashiach come. This is either a great thing or a dangerous thing, depending on your perspective.
How could one say that?
I don't know. I have to learn Kabbalah to figure out the answer to that question. I don't know. I know that I looked in the introduction of the Etz Chaim, and Rav Chaim Vital writes there that the reason Mashiach has... Yaakov Hillel is probably the most well-known Kabbalist today in Jerusalem. He publicly teaches Kabbalah. Probably one, he's one of the few people who gives shiurim.
What's his name?
Yaakov Hillel. Rabbi Yaakov Hillel, he has a kollel called Avas Shalom, a yeshiva called Avas Shalom. Right, on Strauss, by the bus stop on Strauss, you can see it just there by that big open space in Bad Wittenberg. He wrote a book called Something and Something, Faith and Folly. Faith and Folly, where he goes through some of the things that people are saying is Kabbalistic and says whether they're legitimate or whether they're not legitimate. And you can trust him. He is a Sephardi Kabbalist. His Kabbalah is coming from the Rosh Hash. He's also probably the only Kabbalist to be educated in Cambridge University. He was born in India, but he grew up in Manchester. Yaakov Hillel. Rabbi Yaakov Hillel. He's written many, many books on Kabbalah, basic introductions to Kabbalah, commentaries on Kabbalistic books. He publishes a lot. And he republishes older books on Kabbalah. He has a whole book called Binyan Ariel, where he tries to explain why people should not be learning Kabbalah unless they're appropriate, and explains what Chaim Vital meant when he said you should be learning Kabbalah. He meant you shouldn't be learning Kabbalah. And take it with a lot of grains of salt, this idea that everyone should be learning Kabbalah.
What's the name of the book that he published that actually teaches Kabbalah?
Oh, many, many books.
Oh, they're still in print. They're in print.
Yeah, he lives in, I think he lives in Gula. His kollel is there, and he gives shiur every day, and you can... I don't think women. Women can go and speak to him, ask him questions. I definitely know of people who've gone to speak to him. And he speaks English. So, yes.
You're saying before... Okay, so people learn their Kabbalah through different sources. But if Hasidus... is essentially like a form of Kabbalah, how is it then that, like, because I've heard that, like, this is your saying, like, you know, people are saying it's really important people be learning Kabbalah. I've heard, like, it's very common, it's really important now people be learning Hasidus, and if you're not learning that, then, like...
That must be Lubavitcher who said that.
Probably.
Yeah, okay.
But
no, just as a general rule,
yeah.
If they say Hasidus, it means Lubavitch. Lubavitcher say Hasidus, it means Lubavitch Hasidus, and no one else's. Everyone is what?
So let's say... Okay, so
a Lubavitcher would only learn that, and they say you've got to learn Chassidus to bring the Mashiach. all other Chassidim say you should learn Chassidus and it's an important part of your thing.
I don't
but
think you should learn Chassidus from Mashiach, but you should learn Chassidus, like, stand to learn Chassidus, because it's like,
right.
You're left, like,
right.
That's what you're doing.
Right.
But my question is, how is it that there's such a void, if you said that the greatest insult would be to tell the guy who's a Chassid? How is it that there's this like common umbrella of Kabbalah and we should all be like in each other Kabbalah?
Oh, because they're completely different ways.
That's my question. So what's the difference between
nature of God?
Chassidus Kabbalah and
it's the nature of God. Since all of Kabbalah is about how
Kabbalah,
God
not Chassidus Kabbalah.
About God and about how God interacts with the world.
Okay.
And they argue on the most fundamental issues of the nature of God. To the extent that from the Leshem's perspective, Chassidus is basically paganism, panentheism.
Can you go a little?
Not really.
Haven't you spoken about this before?
Yeah. Yeah. But whatever. I mean, the question is how God interacts with the world. Nature of Tzimtzum. But also the concepts. That it ends up, the same words mean different things.
Who were on the other side saying that Chassidus is evil?
Who says it's evil?
Yeah.
The Leshem.
The Leshem.
Leshem. He wrote a book. He wrote four books. The books are all called Leshem Shvo VaAchlama, and there's Sefer Birim, Sefer Klalim, Sefer Dea, and Hakdamas Sharim. And then there's a book called Sharia Leshem, which is a compilation of his greatest hits.
How do you feel about him? I don't like him right now, and I don't even know him.
I was waiting for no answer to that question.
Quickly moving on because near the end. So there's different traditions in Kabbalah. I just want to go back in summary, Kabbalah is a valid part of authentic Judaism. There are many different understandings of what Kabbalah says about the world. It's important to know what's the difference, what is actually a Kabbalistic idea and what's not a Kabbalistic idea. because the differences between them are very, very subtle. To the extent,
if
you can very easily end up worshipping idols if you think that something is God that's not really God. If you think in this world is that and this instead, if you're doubling to God in the world of Bri instead of the world of Atsilas, then you're worshipping idols. I mean, very, very subtle things that don't really have any meaning in normal way to think about things can make a huge difference. So you have to be careful with what you're doing and know what you're doing and understand it. Do not believe everybody who says something is Kabbalistic. So I just want to go through these five questions that I was asked, or at least four of them. And yeah.
You know when the Maharal made the guy wanted to use Kabbalah to do that?
That's what I was going to say.
He didn't make the golem, though. It's a myth.
No, but it's fascinating that he's a practicing Kabbalist, but his writings are considered mysticism.
Yeah, I don't believe he could have made a golem.
A
golem is a man made out of clay.
Wait a minute.
I know there's a story. I know there's a story, and I think there probably was a golem in Prague. I don't think it was the Maharal who made it, because I don't think the Maharal. The Chacham Tzvi has a tshuva, quoted in the Ramah Shulchan Aruch, about whether you can count a golem for minyan or not. I think it's a nunches. I think it's a nunches in the Shulchan Aruch. The Mishnah Berurah brings down this question of whether you can count a golem or not. So it seems that either it was a golem or there's a likelihood of being a golem. But the Chacham Tzvi is not the... And the Chacham Tzvi did not make it, but he talks about it, and it seems unlikely to me that it was the Maharal who made it.
But it was somebody else that did it.
I'm not even sure it was the same time. At the time of the Maharal either, it doesn't really make sense. I don't believe that story. But if it was true, then he must have known some kind of Kabbalah.
But even so, he was considered to be a practicing Hindu.
Really?
Who was the Chacham Tzvi?
I don't think there's anything... the father of Yaakov Emden. He wrote a book called Chacham Tzvi. I can't remember his name. His last name was not Emden, because Rabbi Yaakov Emden changed his last name when he went to be the rabbi of Emden. I've never seen anything, I don't know very much Maharal, but I've never seen anything in the Maharal that looks Kabbalistic at all. So if he did know practical Kabbalah, he certainly didn't write about it. The Gra writes about, many people write about the dangers of practical Kabbalah nowadays, that we shouldn't be messing around with it. Everyone I know who learns Kabbalah is not learning practical Kabbalah. No one's trying to build a golem. No one's trying to do strange things and put curses on people or things like that using Kabbalah. That can be very, very dangerous, and keep well away from it. The five questions were, why was the Kabbalah or Zohar accepted if it seemed to be in contradiction with earlier concepts? So this I didn't really talk about. I'll try and answer now. It is definitely true that there are ideas in the Zohar that contradict normative halacha. There are many ideas in the Zohar that don't contradict halacha, but are complement halacha. If you see a statement attributed to Kabbalah which contradicts something in halacha, I would say that halacha wins over Kabbalah if there's a machlokas between the two. The Vilna Gaon said there's only three discrepancies between the Kabbalah and Halacha, and everything else is a misunderstanding. But the things that don't contradict Halacha, Kabbalah has the force of a minhag. If people have accepted doing this based on Kabbalah, if you find the Magen Avraham brings it down as a thing, if you find an authentic Jewish source who says this is a traditional Jewish custom based on Kabbalah, then it's probably worth doing it as a minhag. But if somebody tells you something is Kabbalistic without giving you a source, or without showing you where it says it, and says, well, you're not old enough to know it, or you can't understand, then just say, show me a source. So that's in terms of halacha. In terms of hashkafa, the Zohar certainly was rejected by people, and the Kabbalah was... Many people were nervous of that because it seemed to contradict earlier concepts. I would say it gives more dimension to existing, to earlier, or not earlier, since we say the Zohar, the Kabbalah goes all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu, not earlier concepts, but that I think my understanding of Kabbalah is that it fleshes out existing concepts and makes them three-dimensional. In terms of, the Gemara will say a very basic statement of how God interacts with the world, let's say God's in the seventh heaven or something, and the Kabbalah will explain what that means and how that works, and the different worlds and the different spheres within the worlds and the different parts of him, and all these different ideas of actually making it into a real picture. I don't think it contradicts anything of earlier concepts. In Hashkafa, I'm going to be very radical here, in Hashkafa you don't have to follow the majority opinion, even though there are many who would say that you do. I believe that if the Rambam says something, or if the Ibn Ezra says something, or if any of the people who are accepted as major Jewish thinkers say something, then it can't be heretical to believe that, even if Das Torah nowadays says differently. I was discussing 2 days ago with somebody with a Kirov organization. They were talking about Gilgulim, about reincarnation. Right? Reincarnation really became accepted as part of normative Judaism after the Arizal. He wrote a whole book called Sefer HaGilgulim, who explains how it works and why it works and what it does and who's the Gilgul of who. And probably post-Arizal, most people accept that it's a normative Jewish belief to believe in reincarnation. However, many, many of the Rishonim did not believe in Gilgulim. Sadi Gaon says explicitly it can't be. Many people talk about why it can't be and why that's not a Jewish belief. I would venture to say that if a person today says, I find I have a hard time believing in reincarnation, it doesn't rest well with me, I think that's a legitimate Jewish belief. I don't think that we can turn around and say that retroactively all the Gedolim who said that it was not, that there were no Gilgulim, we can't say that retroactively they're no longer valid Jewish sources. Just as in Halakha, we don't just rule over them, overrule them, so on Hashkafa also. So I think it might be wise to follow what most people are following, but I don't think it's an obligation. I don't believe there's a majority rule. I don't believe that that you can say this is a valid Jewish belief and this is an invalid Jewish belief, if you've got a source that says what you're saying. In other words, they may both be true, depending on your perspective. So the question I didn't read, question number 3, someone told me there are Gedolim today who do not hold of the Zohar, but they do not want their names out there because they would lose credibility, their influence on the cult, etc. I've never heard of those people, I don't know, I can't comment on that. There are people out there teaching mysticism and Kabbalah and Zohar who I think don't really know what they're talking about. A lot of people. A lot of popular teachers of mystical concepts actually don't know what they're talking about. I think Martin Berg? Philip Berg? Yeah, okay. Someone told me that he does know. His sons were in school with my neighbour. He said they're the most brilliant people he's ever met. Someone told me that Philip Berg does know Kabbalah. I think everything he's in the Kabbalah said is entirely invalid. And when there's a lot of money involved, you can be fairly sure that it's not.
But is it making a Chol Hashem that he's doing that?
Maybe it's bringing Mashiach. I don't know.
It's a smile Shabbos is coming on the billboard right above, and it's your
Pico,
so you see it like everybody does.
I don't know. I would try very hard not to have anything to do with him. Or his books, or his...
They always wear white on the show. Completely white, and they're all carrying towels to go under the... all the men. But then they have their cell phones in their pockets.
And they're not Jewish?
I don't know.
Okay. No, I don't know. It sounds...
It's not really...
More than very, very strange to me, and I would keep well away from it. As a religion, I'm a practicing Kabbalist. Right. What religion are you? I'm a Kabbalist. It has about as much validity to me as being a Jedi. A Jedi. A Jedi is a real. A Jedi is real.
You don't know.
Like a Star Trek thing like that.
Yeah, Star Wars. I don't hold to the Kabbalah Center, which is not to say that what they're saying is not Kabbalah. Maybe it is, but. And maybe it's bring Mashiach, and maybe I don't understand things, but it makes me very, very nervous, and I would keep well away from it.
Mom, when we were becoming more religious, my mom asked my uncle to find Berliner.
Oh, yeah.
And she said, what's the story? Is it stay away? There's a thousand children on Pico. It's not like...
It's partial that you should stay away. You should certainly not pay any money to anybody who offers you to any Kabbalistic kind of... So there's some...
Follow water.
Yeah, some woman was suing the head of one of the Kabbalah centers because her husband was dying of cancer, and he sold her some Kabbalah water that was guaranteed to cure him, and he died, and it turned out the Kabbalah water had come from Lake Ontario or something, and actually wasn't Kabbalah water after all, and whatever it was.
What is Kabbalah? I mean...
There's no such thing as Kabbalah water.
There's no such thing, so...
I don't know, if you say a brach on water, it becomes holy water, if you're a chassid. So fine, and if you're not a chassid, it becomes holy because you made a bracha.
Maybe it's Rabbi Bert Shariah and he sold it as Kabbalah water.
Exactly, who knows? It's mikveh Rebbe water. Rebbe mikveh
yeah.
water, what is that?
I don't care who the Rebbe is, he should be drinking mikveh water. And that's what you were saying. That's what you said, right?
You buy bottles of Rebbe mikveh water. It's diluted. As another can keep on diluting it. It keeps going for a long time. Anyway, don't spend money. Anyone who wants money from you for anything Kabbalistic, run away as far as you can, as fast as you can. That's a good rule of thumb. Do read Rabbi Yaakov Hitler's book, Faith and Folly, which was just revamped. I think they have it on the shelf here somewhere, but they reprinted it a couple of years ago and revised it. And he goes through many of these kinds of practices and says which ones are legitimate Jewish practices and which ones are not. If you're in doubt, do go and find somebody who you trust who you can ask. But I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about people who are considered mainstream rabbis in the Kiruv world or in the Haredi world who are saying ideas that are supposed to be Kabbalistic, and I'm not at all convinced that they necessarily know what they're talking about. I also don't know what I'm talking about, so it's entirely possible that I'm wrong, but I don't trust anybody.
I think because it's cool stuff. It's stuff that people...
It's sexy.
Right.
Kabbalah is sexy.
Right.
Kabbalah is great for Kiruv because people love it. But you don't actually have to know anything. You just have to say something, make it sound mystical, and people come running. Yeah, it has the potential, in my mind, it has the potential to be very dangerous. So, fine. If we are obligated to hold the Zohar these days, does that mean that we cannot hold what the Rambam said on contradicting issues? So I said, I think we can, even though there are people who disagree. There are people who would say that for this generation, Rambam's ideas are not appropriate, not valid, not correct, and basically that you should not be studying Rambam or following his position. And Rambam means virtually all of the Rishonim. There are people who say such a thing. My opinion is not like that you are allowed to hold different sources. But before you even get to that question, you have to make sure that what the person is saying is actually a normative Jewish belief today before you start saying it's not like the Rambam. Or is this something they just made up and decided this is what it is? Is it something, or is it actually something valid? And then, you have to look at the balance of opinion. If this makes sense to you and that doesn't, I think people have different kinds of souls. These things speak to some people differently than other people, and you find the one that you're comfortable with. On the other hand, if you find that everybody says one thing, and, no, not everybody. If you find that the people you really respect, the most intelligent, knowledgeable people, are saying one thing and you want to say something different, then you have to check whether you're making the right judgment call. Does the idea there's no such thing as coincidence come from the Zohar? No, it's basically a Gemara. But what does it mean depends on who you look at and who you understand and how you interpret it. In other words, even if the Zohar would say such a thing, the Gemara says that a person doesn't stub their toe without an explicit command from heaven that's going to happen to them, which sounds to me pretty much the same as no such thing as coincidence. The Gemara talks about I just learned this morning a Gemara that talks about if I give my field to a tenant farmer to work for me and it gets flooded or pestilence or locust or something, everything dies, so I can say to him that God had it in for you and you're obligated to pay me. And even if, or the other way around, that even if all the fields around are suffering and he decides he's not going to bother working because I can have complaints on him that he didn't work because maybe God wouldn't have afflicted him. I think no such thing as a coincidence in its general form comes from the Gemara. How that applies, I think, is it's very often misapplied and people, rather than take responsibility for their actions and the actions of those around them, say, oh, well, it's all hashgacha pratis and everything's coming from God, and in doing so. And it, I think that ultimately that's really normative chassidus. But when you say that, then you're also forced to say that you've got no free choice, which Rav Tzadok writes something like that. That on the deepest level, you have no free choice. But it certainly looks to us as though we have free choice. In the world we live in, we're acting as if we have free choice. And therefore, in the world we're living, we have to act as if everything is not. As if there is such things as coincidences, and as if we are responsible for our actions. At its most deepest form in Kabbalah, it could be that there is no such thing as coincidence. It could be there's no such thing as free choice. But I don't know if you have to, I don't think that has to make a difference to the way you live your life. I think it would be very damaging if a person just lets life happen to them and say everything is directly from God, and they're abdicating responsibility and free choice. And that is the end of the shiur.
Thank you.